So we're going to talk about treatment of enemy civilians in times of war. This comes right after the, that ruling that some people are happy with and we're not happy with the ICJ. Maybe it depends what your expectations were, right? So I want to begin with put perspective on this is not the first time that Israel has been accused of attacking enemy civilians. On July 1st, 1982, the IDF forces lay siege to Beirut to eradicate the Palestinian Liberation Organization from its headquarters there. A few days before the siege of Beirut began, IDF troops fought PLO troops in Sidon and nearby Ain Hilwa. I hope I'm pronouncing it correctly. It's a Palestinian refugee camp established in 1948. The PLO troops were shooting at the IDF from a hospital building in Sidon, and inside the hospital were not only militiamen, but also hospital staff, patients, mm-hmm. and many non-combatants who sought refuge there. The IDF sent in negotiators to permit everyone to leave, even fighters without weapons. And what happened was the PLO fighters escaped overnight with weapons. IDF sent negotiators to Ain Hilwa, where 120 PLO fighters barricaded themselves, but they refused to negotiate. The mullah there, who was declared victory or death, so the IDF went house to house until the last resistance was eliminated. Now, two Israeli military correspondents in 1982 viciously criticized the IDF soldiers for pulverizing the city, despite the fact that the IDF warned civilians in advance over loudspeakers and dropped leaflets, even at the cost of losing an element of surprise. And they utilized infantry assaults first instead of heavy artillery bombardments and airstrikes. And they aimed heavy weapons at tactical objectives rather than simply leveling the area. And of course, the question is, how do you balance the moral responsibility to try to avoid non-combatant deaths and the strategic advantage in doing so with by overly endangering the IDF soldiers? Now, Rabbi Shlomo Brody, he's actually coming, as a scholar in residence, in June. He has written extensively on contemporary ethical and social dilemmas. He wrote a book on this topic, and in this book, he cites Michael Walzer, and let's look at the first source here. Now, Michael Walzer is an American political theorist. He's a former Princeton professor who wrote about the classic just war theory. So it says here, and this is he summarizes this, Rabbi Brody in his book summarizes this. He writes that the classic just war theory utilized the doctrine of double effect. There are many variations to the doctrine, but most go something like this. Number one, intent. The military act is intended as an act of self-defense. B, the collateral damage is not intended. C, the collateral damage is not a means to the end of the act, i.e., one does not intend for the collateral damage to serve as a deterrent or provide some other benefit. So number one, you have to have good intent. Number two, is precautionary measures. Efforts are made to avoid or minimize collateral damage. And C, proportionality, the collateral damage is proportionate to the importance of the mission. And how Rabbi Brody sort of summarizes this is to preserve the DDE doctrine, the ethicist Michael Walzer contends that it's insufficient for soldiers to not intend to kill the non-combatants. They must also take proactive actions, what's called due care, to avoid incidental civilian losses, even if it comes with accepting soldier casualties. The soldiers, in short, require, quote, double intention, to mentally intend to strike only the legitimate target and to display positive intention towards saving civilian lives. In practice, this means that soldiers must take risks for themselves to minimize harm to enemy civilians. For the human rights of the enemy civilians, like the rights of their own people, must be protected. So in other words, this theory by Michael Walzer means that even if there is no intent for collateral damage, soldiers still have to take proactive actions to avoid incidental civilian losses, even if it comes with accepting soldier casualties. In other words, this double intention is to strike only legitimate targets and to display positive intention towards saving civilian lives. In other words, this theory by Michael Walzer requires, this, he's not saying this about Israel specifically, he's saying it's in general, this doctrine, this requires greater risks for soldiers to protect the lives of enemy civilians. In other words, if you just take the view that what we care about is intent, your intent is to minimize civilian casualties, then, okay, you have intent, but this theory goes further than that and says you actually have to take proactive steps to protect the lives of enemy civilians. The question is the Jewish view agree to this theory? The Jewish view towards enemy civilians in a conflict has been heavily influenced by a comment by the Maharal. And the Maharal, many Mefarshim asked on the story of Shimon and Levi, where Shimon and Levi wipes out the entire city of Shechem. And how could Shimon and Levi wipe out the entire city of Shechem? There was one man who forced himself, who kidnapped Dinah, forced himself upon Dinah, and then Shimon and Levi, what do? They wipe out the entire city. So a lot of the Mefarshim ask, they say that these are Shvatim, these are good people. How could they have engaged in this behavior? And there are different theories as to how they're able to, they're able to do that. The Maharal asked this question, I only have it in Hebrew, but I'm going to translate. He says, Al kashem Shechem chata, kolayir machatu la'arog. I understand that Shechem may have committed a capital crime of kidnapping, forcing himself, or the son forcing himself on Dinah, but the whole city? Why should the whole city be killed? So first he cites the Rambam, Teiritz HaRambam, the B'nei Noach Mitzuvim al Hadinim. There are seven Noachide laws. One of the Noachide laws is what? Dinim. How do you remember the seven Noachide laws? Aleph, Beis, Gimel, Dalet. Right, three cardinal sins. Idolatry, Avodah Zarah, Gila Raios, right? Adultery and murder, right? Shvichus Dabi. And then Aleph, Beis, Gimel, Dalet, right? Eifer, Midachai, ripping off a limb from a live animal. Number two, and eating it, and number two is cursing God, Birkat Hashem, Gimel, Gzela, and Dalet Dinim. So the Rambam posits that the city violated the prohibition of Dinim, Vavera Achash Over, Neregal Yado, and it's a capital crime. They have seven Noahide laws, and the punishment is death. Bekan ro hamasa raze velo danuhu lekakol yuchayv misa shelo yudani moso. So the Rambam posits, a difficult assertion, but he posits that they should have judged the individual who kidnapped and forced himself on Dina, and the whole city did not, and therefore they deserve the death penalty. Now the Maharal reads this, and I'm sure it's a very incredible assertion. He says, the Maharal says, how could the Rambam say this? It's very difficult. How could, right, these were lowly inhabitants, right? Shechem and Hamor, this is the prince and the head of the city. How could the lowly inhabitants rise up against the son of the prince? Ki ayu rebehem, they were afraid of them. V'afagav shenitzdavu al hadinim, and even though one of the seven Noachide laws, you should engage in judgment, or you should judge, adjudicate, and follow the right laws, and adjudicate people who need to be adjudicated. That's only when you're able to do that. Hayne kashuchu ladun avonos rachman apatre. But if it's an unavoidable circumstance, then the Torah exempts them. Eich efcher lahem ladunosam. How could they have judged him? So the Maharal does not like the Rambam's theory, and he gives his own theory. He says, Venira delo kashamidi. And this paragraph by the Maharal is really the basis for a dominant Jewish position on enemy civilian non-combatants. Venira delo kashamidi. Mishum delo da mishne umos. You can't compare two different nations. Kigod b'nei Yisrael chnadiyim, like the Bnei Yisrael and the Canaanites. Shem Shnei Umos. They're two different nations. Kidichsiv, Vahayu La'am Echad. What did the people of Shechem say? We're going to circumcise ourselves and we'll marry into your children and we'll be like one nation. So right now they are like two different nations. Mitchilo Nechshu La'am Echad. So there were two different nations. Ulefichach, Hutar Lahem Lilchom Kedin Uma Sheba Lilchom Uma Acheres. And therefore, it was permitted for Shimon and Levi to wage war like the law of a nation that wages war in another nation. Sheitira Torah. The Torah allows you to engage in warfare. V'yafal gav d'abra Torah ki sikrav al'ir l'lchem alev v'kores alev l'shalom. Even though ideally, when you approach another city to wage war, you should first try to seek out peace. Hainu hecha delo asal Yisrael davar. That's only when they didn't do anything bad to the Jewish people. Avah heche de asal Yisrael davar. But if they did something bad to the Jewish people, kagon zesha partzu bahem lasos lem nevala, that they engage in this malicious act of kidnapping Dina. Avah gav delo asal rak echad mehem, even though only one of them did this. Keva de mechlala amhu, since they are part of a nation, right? This was an individual from a different nation who attacked a member of the Jewish people. Kevan sheparzam tchila, since they attacked them first, mutarim likach nikmasa mehem. They're allowed to, Jewish people can take revenge for them. V'hachanami kol ha-milchamo sheheim nitzayim. And similarly, all battles that's found, kagon, Sororas ha-Midyanim, when the Bnei Yisrael are commanded to conquer the Midianites. Afal gav dehayu arbei shelo asu, even though many of them were not attacked, were not responsible for causing the Jewish people to sin. This is after the story of with Bilam and the Midyanim and the Moabite women caused the Bnei Yisrael to sin. Ein zechilu kevan shehayu ba'osa uma sha'asa ra lahem. Since if you belong to a nation that did bad to Jewish people, mutarim lavo aleim la milchama, you could wage war against them. V'chein heim kol mechamos, so too by all battles. In other words, and we have to see how broadly this is applied. But the Maral seems to take the position that when Shimon and Levi were waging war against the other nation, that they could. They could attack also non-combatant civilians as part of a war. Now the question, of course, is: well, do you need to? Like, is it like maybe the only way you could think about this in the story of Shimon and Levi? Maybe the only way that Shimon and Levi could bring Shechem the prince to justice if they kill, you know, unfortunately if they wipe out the whole city. I'm not going to go into that specific. You know that we could question that. But what he's arguing is that when you're waging war one nation against another nation, so then he seems to say that's the unfortunate reality of war. Now the question is, how far does the Maral go with this? He says if you have two nations and nation A attacked you, you could go and attack them back. And even if there are going to be civilian casualties, because that's the nature of war. Okay? Now you're going to ask, well, how far do you go about this? The Midchas Asher sort of narrowly views, you know, he's a little more narrow in terms of how to interpret this position. This is Rav Asher Weiss says, I mean, big question is, can you simply kill enemy civilians even if doing so is unnecessary in the objectives of war? In other words, Rav just says, we have two nations, if a member of another nation attacks you, then you're fighting the other nation. If there is innocent civilians who get killed, that's what happens. Yeah. Did they kill the women? I don't think they killed the women. No, I think they're just the men. So you can argue that they were nervous. They wanted to take revenge. If you're going to go after the king, then what's going to happen? Everyone's going to try to defend the king. So the only way you can go against the king and his son is if you wipe everyone else out. That's probably what they were thinking. Right. Right. Yeah. No, I understand. So the question is, what's the necessity about doing so? Now, the morale just seems to say you're allowed to. Are there any limitations? We're going to see that probably most, poskim understand that he's not just saying you can just, if someone from one nation attacks you, you can wipe out everyone carte blanche. We'll see how it's interpreted. But that's what modern day poskim, they use the morale's understanding, who justifies the action of Shimon and Levi, who wipe out the entire city because of this position. Yeah.
I mean, that's not so far. Right. Before we start limiting, that's not such a revolutionary idea. That's just an idea of basic self-defense. Country A attack country B is allowed to...
Right, right. Again, the question is, do you have to... Well, again, Michael Weiser says you have to be concerned about... Yeah. So this is the broadest definition. And it seems intent doesn't matter either, according to the morale. The question is, how nearly did you define the morale? Morale gives the most broadest legitimacy to simply attack another nation when you can attack certain people from that nation, it seems you can attack the whole nation. That's the broadest definition of the morale. The Rav Asher Weiss, in Mincha, he's Rav Asher Weiss, so he's a big posik nowadays, and he writes in Minchas Asher, this is in Devarim Lamed Beis Pasuk Vav, so he cites a pasuk, I think it's from Divrei Yamim, if I'm not mistaken, it says, Vahid alai Devar Hashem, dam shafakta mechamos kadosa, sisa losim ne bayis lishmi. So David HaMelech is saying that Hashem told David HaMelech, why can't you build the Beis HaMikdash? Why can't David HaMelech build the Beis HaMikdash? Too much blood in his hands, right? Because you're not going to build it? Because kidamim rabim, exactly what he said. Kidam rabim, shafak tar tzal afarai. Because you, too much blood on your hand. You spilled too much blood. And the radak, the Rav Asher Weiss cites the radak on that pasuk. It's of Amro. Damim larov shafak tar tzal kidam nekiim haya bedamim asher shafak. And when he said that he spilled a lot of blood, well, first of all, there was innocent blood, which he spilled, like the blood of Uriah. Gam bidmei hagam asher shafak osam. Also, the blood of the nations that David HaMelech spilled that were not waging war. After Shayim Hem Anashim Tovim Mechasidim, there probably were also some good people there also. V'afal pichen lo nenash aleihem. David wasn't punished for this. In other words, God didn't tell David that you're not building the Beis Hamikdash because you killed innocent people. He just said you spilled blood. Words, I don't want to have someone who waged war building the Beis Hamikdash. God does not say, at least the way the Radak understands this, that the reason why you're not building the Beis HaMikdash is that you committed sins in killing innocent people in the context of war. So why is that? So he says, Ki kavanoso lachalos harasha'im, his intent was to wipe out the wicked people, shal yifritzu b'Yisrael, they shouldn't spread among the Jewish people, ulahatzil atzmo kishoy beres plishtim, lo yichle ish vishan, sometimes when he had to save himself, he couldn't let anyone remain alive, aval kevin shidiz dami lo shvichas dami lo rov, manu mi livnos beis hamikdash, shula shalom l'chaparas avu ulateres tefila. And he says the reason, he says that is because he just killed a lot of people. And therefore, he was prevented from building the Beis HaMikdash, which is for peace and for atonement of sin and for prayer. So in other words, David HaMelech was not punished for killing innocent civilians in the context of war. That's where the Radak writes. And Rav Asher Weiss says, V'lamadnu af midvar, we learn from his words, D'me'ikar adin, according to the circular of the law, Ein li'imana meharigas harotzchim, afim hechvim mepesha, Neragimi Mahem, that you're not prevented from killing murderers, even if innocent people also are killed with them. Umishum kach lo nenash David al dam rav shafach. Therefore, David was not punished for the blood that he was poured. Elishim kovka mano kadosh baruch hu mi livnos es shel shvichas damim. I think it's a word missing. That Hashem prevented him from building the Beis HaMikdash because of the blood that he spilled, but not because he killed innocent blood, not because he killed innocent people. And also from his words we can understand, as we explained above, Devada Yeshli Shtadel B'Miniyas Hariga Sam Shel Elu Shelo Pashu V'Lo Chatu. So Rav Asher Weiss certainly goes without saying that you should try to prevent the killing of those who did not commit a sin. Of kishei afshar, however, when it's impossible, gam heim nisfim im eila, it should be im eila shebekirbam shemitzvah lahargo. But he says that you're not punished if for killing innocent civilians if there's no other option to achieve your military objective. So it gives a little narrower view of the Maral. And also, if you see Rav Herschel Schachter in Be'ikve Tzon, Rav Schachter quotes the Minchas Chinuch. He says, "Didin pikuach nefesh." We know that to put your life in danger, that overrides any mitzvah in the Torah, except for the big three. Ulechol isur Torah, right? So what would you say? You can't, maybe you can't, are you allowed to wage war? How are you allowed to wage war? You're putting your life on the line. How are you allowed to wage war? So he says, Haynu davka shelo bishas b'chaba. Minchas Chinuch says these rules, that you're not allowed to put your life in danger, that only applies not in the context of war. There are different rules when it comes to war. You can't take the view that says, oh, we have to follow pikuach nefesh when it comes to waging war, because then what would happen? You can never wage war. There's always a danger to chayalim. And what would you say? Would you say that when one person, that if one soldier might be killed, therefore you can't wage war ever? No, that's not. It's obviously not true. So the concept of bikuach nefesh, putting your life on the line, only applies under normal circumstances. But when it comes to waging war, you can wage war even if it might result in loss of life. And then he says, ela vadai davar baro. However, it's clear. Shebematzav shemilchama love din shebikuach nefesh. The rules of bikuach nefesh do not apply when it comes to waging war. Sheim. Then he writes the next paragraph. Sheim yisorech bakach sheyiru bahem almanas larok. And if there's a need, you got to fire because to kill people. And sometimes it's impossible to clarify who are the attackers, who are the terrorists, who are trying to who are trying to attack and bring about the attacks and the terror attacks. Rasha'im v'chayavim tzahal la'akos. The tzahal are permitted and are obligated to attack, to respond, or even to preempt. V'af la'ro kefi hadarush le'natzeach b'mochama. And even to kill according to what's necessary to be victorious in battle. Af acherim me'osamwa. They're even allowed to kill those who are from the same nation. Shem chefim me'pesha. That they are innocent from any sin. Uchemavur begur arya lemaral mi Prague. So he cites the Maral mi Prague. Rav Herschel Schachter quotes the Maral mi Prague, and he basically takes the view he is rejecting Michael Walzer, and he's saying that your goal is simply intent, simply intent. If you intend to, you have a military objective. You have a military objective. That's your objective. You want to stop the terrorists from fighting. You want to save Jewish lives. Or you want to save lives of your country. You are allowed to attack the enemy if they are immersed in civilian, you know, with civilians, or they're in schools, or they're in other hospitals. And the only way you can stop the attacks is to attack the hospitals, the schools, whatever the case is, so then you would be allowed to, fight back, and even if others who are innocent get killed. So again, just to be clear, just where we're starting with, we have Michael Walzer who says that not only is intent important, but you have a proactive responsibility to minimize casualties of enemy non-combatants. You have the Maral, who seems to take potentially a very expansive view that when you attack the other nation, if you kill civilians, it's part of war. And Rav Schachter and Rav Asher Weiss, and this is a general view, they're saying no. You need to have intent to that your military, that your objectives are necessary. Yeah.
Right. Did their positions come only from logic, or do they have sources?
You're saying to limit it.
Certainly logical what they're saying.
Yes.
But is it beyond logical? What's the lamas?
The lamas is simply that they care about human life. I don't know the value if we care about every person's. Kol mekayim nefesh achas. I mean, it's only with Jews, but like that everyone's created in the image of God. I think there's some basic notion that it's like a basic notion that every human being was we don't just kill innocent human. We don't kill innocent human beings, right?
I mean, for example, to distinguish between the just war theory,
right.
Right.
So we're going to so
distinction come from
right. The question is, can you theoretically, to save one member of your nation, are you allowed to kill 1,000 people? Is there a limit? That's really the question between, let's say, Michael Walzer's view, and let's say the Maharal's view as we understand it. The question is, if in order to save one Jewish life, or you know, the life of 10 soldiers, let's assume there weren't PR issues, and there weren't hostages that they're afraid that they're going to kill if they carpet bomb the area, and by carpet bombing, then they will probably save Jewish lives.
And be more effective.
Right. So if you see here, this is the source I have here, Rabbi Jachter cites, and he cites up there are a bunch of articles in Tchumen. And we see here, he says, the Israeli army is clearly entitled to risk the lives of civilians in their efforts to eradicate terrorists. That's all the posts can agree, based on the morale, based on the Radak. The crucial question, though, is whether civilized countries must risk their soldiers' lives in order to reduce civilian casualties. This question is debated by leading post-coup of our generation. Avraham Lichtenstein believes that Israel must absolutely consider the extent of the justification of killing a large group of civilians mixed with enemy soldiers in order to save the life of an individual Israeli soldier. In other words, Rav Avraham Lichtenstein believes that the amount of civilian casualties is a factor to consider when conceiving battle plans. Now, how much should it be considered is another question. And maybe it has to do something with proportionality, that the collateral damage is proportioned to the importance of the mission. He is one posek who I think may subscribe to Walzer's just war theory. He argued in this article in Tchumim, he says, every individual was created in the image of Hashem. Hashem did not allow us to sing when the Egyptians were drowning in the Red Sea. So we do need to think about proportionality. And when I say proportionality, I don't mean, well, if they killed one, then we can kill one. It means that you evaluate the importance of the mission with how many, the importance of the mission versus how many, the likelihood of enemy civilians being killed. And he also writes in Tchumim that we need to think about the impact that killing civilians has on us. Most poskim will disagree with Rav Lichtenstein. If you look here, continue on in this passage from Rabbi Jachter's work here, he says that Rav Avram Shapira and Rav Dov Lior strongly disagree. Rav Lior writes, in times of war, there surely exists firm halachic basis for any action taken in order to ensure that not even one soldier is, God forbid, harmed. Rav Schachter and Rav Bleich told me that they agree with Rav Shapira and Rav Lior. In fact, Rav Schachter argues that Israel acted immorally by risking its soldiers in Jenin and Lebanon in order to reduce Arab civilian casualties. Rav Bleich concurred with Rav Schachter that it's forbidden to risk Israeli lives in order to save Arab civilians. Avi Levinson reports that Mordechai Willig told him that he also agrees with the approach of Shapir Rav Lior. Now, as you say, we're talking about being moral and immoral. So, what's being immoral? Is immorality based on, you know, the number of lives that are lost? Or maybe you're saying, no, it's immoral if my job, if I'm being attacked by another nation, and, you know, I didn't start it. If they lay down their weapons, there'll be total peace. I don't want to wage war. But if I'm forced to wage war, then maybe I have a moral responsibility to protect every single soldier who goes to war. And I'm also if I have civilians in my country and they're living, let's say, you know, on the border of Gaza, they're living on the border of Lebanon, and I have a moral responsibility to make sure that they can live normal lives. So you can look at it and say it's immoral to try to protect the life of one person, one of your own civilians, if it means killing 1,000, you know, enemy non-combatant civilians. You could look at it the other way, and that's why I've looked at it. I don't know what the numbers he would say, but he said, yeah, you have to consider how many non-combatant civilians will be killed. But you can look at it the other way. It's immoral for you not to take your own citizens into account first. Right. Again, I don't know if that. Again, if you believe that would be the only way to the best way. Again, there could be other ways, right? You could bomb one area first. I mean, the answer is yes. In other words, if you felt that there seemed to be no limit to attacking. If the military objective is to have zero casualties and to attack the enemy, and to, again, if they surrender, if the enemy surrenders and the enemy laid down their weapons, and this whole thing goes away, it would seem that other than Ravara Lichtenstein, he has some following. That they feel that, yeah, to save one Jewish life is more important. Again, when you didn't start it, that's the whole point. You didn't start, yeah. Right. So that's a question, because they're acting immoral. So the question is, if they're acting immoral, can you act immoral? So I'm not sure about that. I would look at that. I would say it's an act of morality to protect every citizen and every soldier. That's what I would say. Okay, so we're accused, right? So the question is,
This is not
Israel's public position is probably more in line with Rav Aaron Lichtenstein's position. I think his position is related to the just war theory. That's my thinking. I want to sort of address one final question, and that is. To what extent should that play in military decisions? And when I say Chil Hashem, I don't mean PR, what they will say in the International Court of Justice, to the extent that they may impact the strategic success of the war from a political or PR perspective. I don't mean that, because that's an important factor here. I'm saying, let's say that our political leaders took the position that a particular battle strategy would not cause Israel any more PR problems than it already has in the eyes of the world. Like something you say, like, whatever we do, they're going to hate us. So maybe there's no difference. Okay, but I'm not debating that point. But let's say there's a certain battle strategy that you know, they'll either hate us regardless, or they'll be okay with it regardless. So would there be consideration of Chil Hashem that could come from attacks on enemy civilians? In other words, Chil Hashem is a concept in Judaism. There's a mitzvah of Nikdashti B'Sof Bnei Yisrael. They're supposed to make a Kiddush Hashem. And there's also a prohibition of Lo Sechal Lo Hashem Kadshi. There's a prohibition of engaging Chil Hashem. Now, where do attacks on enemy civilians fit into this halachic discussion about Chil Hashem? Right. Correct. 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 So obviously there are different people in the world, and there, no, I'm just saying. For example, you look at the ICJ, the reaction. So again, there are those people who think we're committing genocide. Those people who don't think we're committing genocide, but they want a ceasefire. Those people feel we should try to tone down whatever that means. They have no military back. So the question is, the people hate us anyway. I agree with you, but that's a given. But there are people who are, you know, the world. There's many different. We have friends in the world, by the way. We do have friends in the world, and we have friends in the world. We have friends who support us. And I'm not getting political here. We do have many friends who do so. There are many people in the world who do not support us, but we do have many friends. Most of Congress supports us. We have overwhelming support. We're nervous about the support, but most of Congress has been supportive of us, you know, throughout this war. And so the question is, should we be concerned about any type of Chil Hashem, you know, that could result, or you say, no, they all hate us regardless. So there's no concern of Chil Hashem. So in Rabbi Shlomo Brody's book, he explained, just so we can think about this, there are two broad approaches. I'm going to give you sort of two ways to understand Chil Hashem, and then give two different historical fact patterns and how they reflect different ways of looking at Chil Hashem. So there are two different concepts of two different possible ways to look at Chil Hashem. The first approach is, you could say, that God's reputation rests on the political state of the Jewish people. Israel's exile is seen as a divine failure. The fact that we have a Jewish state is a kiddush Hashem. I believe Rabbi Soloveitchik writes this in, you know, his work on Kol Dodi Dofek, the six knocks. You know, what happened? We got the state of Israel. So we see Hashem was knocking on our door. We saw we witnessed the Yad Hashem, the Hand of Hashem. And he said, it's a tremendous chila. We don't think of it. We think of, what's a kiddush Hashem? Help an old lady cross the street. I don't know. The kiddush Hashem is also, when we're doing bad, that's a chila Hashem. When nation of Israel is doing bad, it's a chila Hashem because...
Come on. This is very upsetting here.
Listen. Okay, I'm not sure who's... Okay, I'm not sure it's upsetting, but okay. So the concept of Chil Hashem is when we're in a low point, then we represent God in this world. So when we're viewed as a lowly nation, so it's a Chil Hashem. And we have a Jewish state. That's a wonderful thing. It's the Kiddush Hashem, that Jewish people were supposed to have a Jewish state. So you could look at the state of Israel and maintaining a strong state of Israel as being Kiddush Hashem. Rav Tzvi Yehuda Cook and his students are associated with this meaning of Kiddush Hashem, that we have to stay strong in the eyes of the world. The nation of Israel has to stay strong. We have a strong country. Then that is a Kiddush Hashem. Second approach of Kiddush, and they're not necessarily mutually exclusive, is that Hashem's reputation is impacted by the moral behavior of the Jews. That how we behave either gives Hashem good reputation or bad reputation. Right? So Rav Amital, right, the Rosh Hashiva, former Yeshiva of Gush, he passed away a number of years ago, he's associated with this meeting. So do you view Kiddush Hashem as strong state of Israel, because this shows that we're supposed to be a people with a nation? Do you view Kiddush Hashem as good behavior? And they're not necessarily mutually exclusive. So I want to share with you two different case studies where these issues were debated. So you're familiar with the massacre of Sabra and Shatila. So they're PLO fighters in 1982. When PLO fighters were evacuated from Beirut on September 1st, 1982, by a multinational force, Lebanon was going to fall under the command of Bahir Gamayel, a Christian Lebanese militia commander of the Falange Party. On September 14th, he was assassinated. A few days later, the Falange militiamen took revenge for his death by killing or wounding thousands of residents in Palestinian refugee camps of Sabra and Shatila near Beirut. Now, Israel established a government inquiry and found that Defense Minister Ariel Sharon and the IDF Chief of Staff were indirectly responsible for this massacre. They should have known that it was going to happen, and they could have taken steps to stop it once it started. Rav Shaul Yisraeli, Rav Goren, and Rav Tzvi Yehuda's premier students, Rav Chaim Drukman, all of them are his students, were against this investigation, and they tried to stop it from happening. They believe that Israel is being scapegoated for actions it did not commit, right? Because they were allied, but they allowed it to happen, but they themselves did not commit it. And accepting any responsibility would only lead to international anti-Semitism. Christians kill Muslims, and Jews are blamed. So there is no outrage, they said, when Lebanese factions were slaughtering each other in the 1970s. However, on the other side, these were allies of the IDF. These militiamen were allies of the IDF. And Rav Abital felt that this event was an enormous chilul Hashem, and he believed that there should be an inquiry. Rav Lichtenstein wrote an open letter to Prime Minister Begin that the national honor of the State of Israel can only be restored through an investigation and introspection. Rav Soloveitchik and Rav Emanuel Jacobowitz supported the inquiry as well. So here, there was no purpose for the attack on the non-combatants except for revenge. And the IDF had the ability and the collective responsibility to temper Falangist behavior. So, and those like the Rav and Rav Lichtenstein and Rav Amital felt that you needed to accept responsibility for the allies' behavior, especially when you could control, when you were behind them, and that they could have stopped them. The IDF had just spent many weeks fighting in Lebanon, trying to minimize civilian casualties. And now, after spending so much time and working really hard to minimize casualties and being a beacon of light in the eyes of the world, again, not in the whole world, but a lot of people who were, you know, who were neutral in terms of they weren't against Israel, and Israel did a good job in terms of minimizing civilian casualties. Now, all of a sudden, this was their behavior. The past few weeks was overshadowed by the unwarranted killing of non-combatants during a ceasefire. And it desecrated the moral heroism of IDF soldiers who made great sacrifices to avoid collateral damage. So this case of Sabra and Shatila was a case where you had this debate, where you had certain students of Tzvi Yehuda Cook who felt that Kiddush Hashem dictates that no government inquiry because we have to be strong. We didn't actually do this, engage in this behavior. And this is just going to lead to weakening of the State of Israel versus a number of leading rabbinic figures who felt that this was a chilul Hashem. Again, because there were people, this would give a bad light on Israel. But there's a second case, the bombing of Cana on April 18th, 1996. Naftali Bennett was the commander of the Maglan Special Forces. He radioed in for emergency help from southern Lebanon. His unit spent the previous 8 days on reconnaissance missions to locate Hezbollah units, rocket launchers, and other targets. And the goal was to try to stop Hezbollah attacks from southern Lebanon. After 8 days of attacks, an IDF helicopter was mistakenly sent during daytime hours to provide supplies to Bennett's unit. So now, one of the subunits was exposed. The enemy knew where he was. So Hezbollah fighters were wearing UN flak jackets. They shot mortar fire from a Lebanese cemetery that landed very close to IDF commanders. The Hezbollah men then ran for cover into a UN compound 550 feet away that was sheltering nearly 800 Lebanese civilians. The IDF quickly launched rescue artillery fire at Hezbollah rocket launchers. However, the artillery fire missed its mark and landed in the UN compound, and over 100 people were killed. another 100 were wounded, and there were gruesome images that were broadcast throughout the world. And the Baruch Hashem, the IDF commandos were extracted to safety. But when you see these gruesome images on TV, so there's a journalist, Robert Fisk, reporting for Britain's Independent, wrote an article with the headline, Massacre in the Sanctuary, and he wrote it was a massacre. Not since Sabra and Shatila had I seen the innocents slaughtered like this. Now Rav Amital at that time was the minister without portfolio in Perez's, Shimon Perez's government, and he described the incident as an indescribable chil Hashem to the nations of the world. And this statement was covered on the front page of the major Jewish paper in England. But Rabbi Shlomo Brody, in his book, writes that he thought this was wrong, because what else could they have done? In other words, chil Hashem should not depend on whether there are gruesome images plastered on the newspaper, on the TV. Right, it's an accident. It's an accident, and the terrorists embedded themselves very close. Yeah, I'm saying these are two very different cases. 10 years later, during the second Lebanon War, the IDF bombed the outskirts of the Kana village from where the Katusha rockets were launched. 28 people were tragically killed, followed by international condemnation. Hezbollah had fired over 150 rockets from the area in previous weeks, but the UN Security Council held an emergency meeting to lambast Israel. Again, we can ask, what could have Israel done to defend itself? So if I were to ask you, you know, sometimes we take extreme views. You know, so you say, should we care about Chil Hashem? No, the world's going to hate us, so we should never, you know, who cares what the world says? So I'm not sure if that's the, if that is the only perspective, or that's a dominant perspective. Should we care about Chil Hashem? Yes, we should care about Chil Hashem. But Chil Hashem should not be based on body counts or on CNN coverage. We should care about following our moral principles constantly and consistently, despite what our enemies do. And then you could have the debate in the case of Sabra and Shatila, where they felt that this was an act of omission. And we could talk about, you know, minimized proportionality of, like, the importance of the mission versus the risk to soldiers. So perhaps we should care about moral principles. Sabra and Shatila may have been a legitimate Chil Hashem, but Kana definitely was not. So I think here are some perspectives on sort of how you look at civilian casualties. You have Walzer's theory. You have the morale. Right, you have the morale. You have, again, the morale, I would not want to suggest that he would say just blatantly just wipe out anyone from the other nation when you're waging war. There needs to be a military objective. I don't think anyone says if there's no military objective, you just attack enemy non-combatants. But you have, I think, a very dominant rabbinic view. If there were no strategic political considerations, then maybe carpet bombing might be the way to go, even to save one soldier, versus a violent state who says, no, you need some level of proportionality. He seemed to perhaps hold of Walzer's theory, it seems to me. And then you have the question of, does Chil Hashem apply? Yes, Chil Hashem does apply, but it's a Chil Hashem is really a question of, you know, acting not about what's plastered on the news, not about the effect, but about following your moral principles in following the war. And if you don't follow those principles, then we have to be concerned about Chil Hashem. Yeah, Evan.
Can